1941 to 1947, war and bloodshed took the developments to an irreversible stage. We had to make the international community understand that the world will never return to the past years. There was a time when the Jews had to stabilize the land they had captured, where we could no longer hope for full and complete support from the British. If the Jews had taken a step back, everything they had achieved would go down the drain. I told myself that, in that unpleasant and dangerous situation, the daughter of the Mabovich family should play a more important role. In 1944, my dad passed away in exile and without having a homeland, and I wanted to do something astounding to keep his memory alive. My dear Carpenter Dad, my first memory from him goes back to the time when we were in Kiev and he boarded up the door of the house out of fear for the rumor that the Jews were being massacred. Death in the U.S. finally found the exact location of Moshe the Carpenter. On the eve of victory in 1947, I had to go to Jordan on a mission assigned by David Ben-Gurion to infiltrate the heart of the Jordanian government, in addition to get information from the Arab armies that were being prepared. I had to do something that no one besides me could do. From all sides of this great war, the mission had reached the border of success or failure. A commission consisting of 11 countries in the United Nations had entered into negotiations about the fate of this piece of land. Canada, Czechoslovakia, the Netherlands, Peru, Guatemala, Sweden, and Uruguay were the majority group of these negotiations. They had proposed the plan to divide Palestine into two Jewish and Arab countries. For the Jews, this plan was the beginning of victory, even if it was not victory itself. After all, the Arabs were already here and had a country. But the Jews had nowhere. They were displaced, a nation scattered all over the world. Even half of the country was better than nothing. But the Palestinians were against it. For them, even losing 10% of their country meant failure. For this reason, the minority group of the negotiations, namely India, Yugoslavia, and Iran, proposed a single country plan and holding a referendum. Obviously, the Jews, after the illegal and forced migration that comprised 40% of the population in Palestine, would be the losers of the plan. That's why our lobbies did something to abort the minority group's plan. The majority group won the negotiation game and finally split Palestine through Resolution 181, one for the Jews and one for the Arabs.
But now,
Afghanistan, no. Argentina, Argentina, abstention. India, no. Iran, no. Iraq, no. Lebanon, no. Ukraine, yes. South Africa, yes. Soviet Union, yes. United Kingdom, abstain. The United States, yes. Uruguay, yes.
We have to turn our achievement from the paper to a reality on the ground. We are ready to do anything to win. Golda Mabovich about to leave Jordan after meeting the king. In the house of a British legionary officer in Jordan, on a mission to convince Abdullah al-Hashimi not to accompany other Arab countries in the formation of the Salvation Army. Since a year ago, I gradually infiltrated the Jordanian army and sent all the information to the organization under the leadership of dear and caring Ben Gurion. Now there is one step left to victory. The Haganah had issued a call for the Jewish youth between the ages of 17 and 25 to join the army. We will put these days behind. We have to think about the future and make plans for it. After this mission, we had to work harder to form a government. Those who accompanied the Jewish patriotism movement during the hard years now had to play their essential role in Israel and its administration. The conflict that started during the 1920 Nebi Musa riots would never end. The Jews had run out of patience. Now others had to pay for our 2,000 years of patience and silence. There was no difference between young and old, men and women, children and adults. There was no difference between military personnel and civilians. The Palestinians did not exist at all, so they could not return. History is written by the victors, and the world has to believe our big lie. They have to keep going further away and stay away from us. From now on, historians should write, there was no Palestinian Arab land before 1948, when the Jews became the absolute victors of the great game of the century. We deny everything. The Romans, Greeks, Herodotus, Babylonians, Iranians, and Ottomans have said nonsense by using such a name in their conversations, correspondence, and maps. How could they come back when they didn't exist here at all? The bigger the lie, the easier it is to believe. Those who decide to object what we say will face more and more bullets, like the people in Al-Dawaima in the south of Al-Khalil, where the lovely and hard-working Zionists were able to finally kill 455 Arabs, while 170 of them were women and children. Of course, they were not women. Their correct name is Shiksa, as mentioned in the Talmud. Like the people in Balad al-Sheikh, a large number of whom worked in the Haifa oil refinery, and the soldiers of the Zionist movement managed to punish them both in the refinery and in their villages for insisting on their wrong and old claim on their lands. Like those 60 people in Safsaf village who were killed at the beginning of Hiram's awesome operation, like those killed in Ain al-Zaytun, like all the previous ones and all the upcoming ones, like all organized terror operations by Zionists throughout the world. What difference does it make how many Arabs, Muslims, and Christians are killed? We will cover the earth and even the seas from the Niles to the Euphrates in order to put an end to the homelessness of the Zionists. It's obvious that no one will worry about these numbers. The elderly will soon die, and the youth will forget everything almost as soon. After all, according to ancient Iranian doctors, the nature of soil is cold, and the dead and their survivors will soon forget the grief. Now is the time for Zionism to achieve victory at any cost. The first minister of labor and the second minister of foreign affairs of Israel. She was the female example of David Ben-Gurion and led the days full of violence and blood as the fourth prime minister of Israel. A woman who tried hard to deny and destroy Palestine as much as her 2,000-year-old anger and died at the age of 80.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
Following the Israeli regime's brutal war in Gaza, most of the Islamophobic incidents in the United Kingdom involve people who are being targeted because of their support for Palestine. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British news reporter The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. A new report has revealed that the number of Islamophobic incidents has risen sharply in the United Kingdom following the Israeli regime's brutal war in the Gaza Strip, leaving British Muslims in fear. According to a report by The Independent on Sunday, 25th of February, most of the Islamophobic incidents in the United Kingdom involve people who are being targeted because of their support for Palestine. A Muslim woman told The Independent that she was targeted because she had a Palestinian flag in her window, adding that she could have been killed by a brick thrown through her window because of her support for Palestine. A 17-year-old teenage student also said he was questioned by his teachers after he displayed a Palestinian badge on his bag at school. The student went on to say that he felt targeted because he was a Muslim, which triggered an anxiety attack and led to exam failure after he was interrogated by teachers about his faith and his understanding of Hamas. A 32-year-old doctor also said he has been too scared to leave his home after an attack he believes stemmed from his support for Palestine. He was awoken on 5th of February after a large rock smashed through a window at his Manchester home, which displayed a Palestinian flag. He said this event has been extremely traumatic and has had a significant impact on his well-being, adding that he was unable to sleep and took 2 weeks off work as a result of the incident. Majid Iqbal, the chief executive officer of the Islamophobia Response Unit, a charity which supports victims of Islamophobia, noted that there was a 365% increase in reports of Islamophobic incidents in October of 2023, following the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas's surprise attack on the occupied Palestinian territories on 7th of October. Majid Iqbal said, since October of last year, the Islamophobia Response Unit has seen a sustained increase in reports to the unit, warning that it is clear that this is now developing into a long-term trend and is having a profound impact on those affected by it. Majid Iqbal further called on press and politicians to not demonize legitimate Palestinian activism and, by extension, British Muslims, to avoid feeding into the serious societal problem of Islamophobia. Talmama, which monitors anti-Muslim incidents, also said there were 2010 Islamophobic incidents between 7th of October last year and 7th of February this year, more than triple the 600 reported during the same period in previous year. The Israeli regime launched its deadly bombing campaign against the Gaza Strip after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas waged Operation Al-Aqsa Storm against the occupying regime. So far, tens of thousands of Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been massacred in the Israeli regime's brutal onslaught on Gaza. Ever since, reports of Islamophobic acts and attacks on pro-Palestinian activists have been growing across the world. Observers say Muslims, especially Muslim women wearing a hijab, have been insulted and attacked on the streets of Britain. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. London's Metropolitan Police said there has been nearly 370% increase in Islamophobic hate crimes in the British capital London amid the brutal Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Between 7th of October last year and 10th of February this year, the Metropolitan Police recorded almost 2,100 Islamophobic incidents in London, up from 600 in the same period last year. Metropolitan Police said a man was arrested for 10 alleged incidents of Islamophobic graffiti at a bus stop in New Malden and in Rains Park in South London. Police said in a statement recently, regrettably, despite the increased presence of police officers, we have seen a significant increase in hate crimes across London. This includes abuse directed at individuals or groups, in person or online, racially or religiously motivated, criminal damage, and other offences. Talmama, which monitors anti-Muslim incidents, said it had received 2,000 cases up to 7th of February this year. London's Mayor Sadiq Khan also confirmed that the war on Gaza Strip is having a direct impact on London and Londoners, with increasing cases of Islamophobia in the British capital London. An independent team of United Nations human rights experts has found racism in the United Kingdom to be systemic and eroding the rights of Muslims and people of colour. The United Nations human rights experts say racism in the United Kingdom is structural, institutional, and systemic, warning that Muslims and black people in Britain continue to encounter discrimination and erosion of their fundamental rights. The United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent said in a statement at the end of a landmark tour of the country, it said, "We have serious concerns about impunity and the failure to address racial disparities in criminal justice system in Britain, deaths in police custody, joint enterprise convictions, and the dehumanizing nature of the so-called stop-and-search policing strategy." The United Nations Human Rights Council appointed experts said during their official visit to Britain, they had gathered evidence of all-too-real trauma felt by Muslims and black people who were suffering racial discrimination and injustice in Britain. The Middle East Eye has also covered the same story and tells us more. Several Muslim human rights groups have jointly denounced state-sponsored Islamophobia facing Muslims across Europe, warning that Muslims are unjustly placed on blacklists around the European continent. Addressing the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE's Human Dimension Conference in Warsaw, Poland recently, seven Muslim civil society groups from Austria, France, Sweden, Spain, and the Netherlands sounded the alarm bell over the climate of state-sponsored Islamophobia in their respective countries. Representatives from Britain, Austria, and France also attended the conference organized by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, where each Muslim group had 3 minutes to address the session. The gathering came just days after Polish authorities banned Mohammad Rabbani, managing director of CAGE, a UK-based advocacy organization, from entering Poland after his name appeared in a no-entry list to the Schengen zone. During his speech at the conference, Adani Al-Kanfoudi, a spokesperson for Muslim Rights Watch in the Netherlands, said he was due to meet Mohammad Rabbani alongside other European Muslim civil rights societies and groups. Kanfoudi said, "This incident, among many others, is a perfect example of a broader pattern where key figures from the Muslim community in Europe are unjustly placed on blacklists."
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market.
Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas.
We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist fishing vessels that have caught chemical combinations. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 meters of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s, of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and Lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper. Okay. But all of a sudden you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the lat-longs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore. Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like, I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s in an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemical weapons. And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump. And if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that today we're taking a look to see what those effects are, we're looking at the fish, we're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years, in some cases 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding an adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, and understanding what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine-clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
Good afternoon. afternoon. I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Bain Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer, an explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedour Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at the Bedour Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility. Everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect our lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the International Platform for Munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. We used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bedour Lakes. Terry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bedour Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bedour Lakes, but they haven't denied it either, and for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas.
Well,
Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kandar experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. 1 million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons, and many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea. Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support clean-up efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
More than 30,000 women and children have been martyred in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza since October 7, 2023. International criticism of the Zionist regime targeting residential areas has been growing as the war grinds on. In December, South Africa accused the Zionist regime of genocide in Gaza in a case filed at the International Court of Justice. More and more children have been starving to death as famine gradually takes hold. Two-month-old Mahmoud Fatouh starved to death last week next door to one of the richest countries in the world. He's one of the now 16 children who have died of hunger in the Gaza Strip. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Al Jazeera English wrote, his voice breaking, Hossein Jaber recalls how his four-year-old daughter was killed by the Zionist regime forces before his eyes. The photographer, who works with the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, was trying to flee Gaza City on December 5th to get his family to safety when his daughter's life was ended. Jaber said as he stood amid massive destruction with his left arm in a cast and held together with external screws, this area was empty. He was hit in the same attack that killed his daughter. He said, there was no one on this road here except the building's residents who were walking out about to leave towards the west as ordered by the army, including my family. I was waiting over there. He gestured to his right. Waiting for them, there were women, children, and elderly folks, and you could see them clear as day. His family had been sheltering in a building for 4 days with friends. Jaber had been staying elsewhere for work until he drove over to evacuate them. He said, describing later on social media how an Israeli tank sprayed the area with bullets. Salama was first. She got to the crossroads with her sister Sarah running behind her towards me, and suddenly intense gunfire broke out. I saw Salama get hit in the neck before my eyes. She was writhing with pain but kept running somehow. I ran to her to embrace her and carry her to the car while my wife and children Omar and Sarah kept running. Jaber is not sure when he was hit in the arm. He still cannot comprehend what happened, he said, pointing overhead in the direction of a buzzing sound and saying there had been surveillance aircraft overhead the whole time, he said. It was apparent to those aircraft that these were civilians fleeing the building and heading westward as per the instructions of the Zionist regime army. We posed no threat. Salome was killed while Sarah, her 9-year-old sister, miraculously survived death when a bullet penetrated her jacket. It went in one side and out the other. Millimeters separated her from death. My 3-year-old son, Omar, still asks me where Salome is. He doesn't understand how she could have been with him walking down the road and now she's just gone. Jaber walks to stand in front of the Boragh school, where his family had told him the Zionist regime tanks had moved in after the refugees staying there had fled. He said, the school was east of the building where my family was. That's why I asked them to exit to the west to stay away from the direction where the tanks were. Walking over to stand where he could point out the building, which had been hit with artillery shells every day they were there. Inside the building, Jobber stands in a dark, burnt-out stairwell, telling Al Jazeera English that this is where his family stayed, crowding into the center of the building to escape the continuous bombing that targeted the building from all sides. Last week, it was estimated that more than 30,000 women and children were martyred in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza. International criticism of the Zionist regime targeting residential areas has been growing as the war grinds on. In December, South Africa accused the Zionist regime of genocide in Gaza in a case filed at the International Court of Justice. More and more children have been starving to death as famine gradually takes hold. 2-month-old Mahmoud Fatou starved to death recently next door to the countries around it. He is one of the now 16 children who have died of hunger in Gaza. According to the United Nations, one child in every six below the age of two is already acutely malnourished. Today, all Jobber's family has of Salama are the digital images of her on his mobile phone. The videos are a testament to joy. Salama can be seen dancing for her father's camera, proudly reading a poem or smiling on a beach. Her father wrote, "Salama's image will remain present in my heart and mind. Salama, my middle daughter, intelligent, affectionate, forever beloved." Salama's fifth birthday would have been on February 4th.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the Commander-in-Chief of Iran's Armed Forces, Imam Khamenei. Martyr Soleimani revived the resistance front and its strengthening must continue. December 31st, 2023. People had seen martyr Qasem Soleimani's presence in the mountains of Syria, his fearlessness, and him moving toward danger. This is very important, but the main significance is that these trips, his presence, and these efforts were able to revive and strengthen the resistance front. May God exalt his rank. He pursued this work with forethought, with resourcefulness, with wisdom, with a moral behavior, with energy, and with endless effort. And this was and is very important. I hope that this movement continues by the will of God. Of course, Mr. Qani, commander of the IRGC Quds Force, is truly and honestly moving very well. Praise God, his endeavors are very good. This path of strengthening the resistance front, which Martyr Soleimani was very active in and very outstanding at, should be continued by the will of God.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
May God protect all of you and his wife as well. She also played a role in Martyr Soleimani's orientation and his motivation. About 20 or maybe 23 or 24 years ago, we prayed in this yard along with approximately 20 of the IRGC commanders. I then sat on the stairs and delivered a very warm, appealing speech. I hadn't planned it beforehand. It was Almighty God speaking. It was my voice, but God's words. It was a very extraordinary meeting, and it had a great impact. After the meeting, a few of those people came to me, and one of them was Haj Qasim. He came and quoted a sentence from her, his wife, and said, "My wife says this." It was similar to the things I had said in that meeting. I noticed how influential a wife is. In other words, this woman had influenced Haj Qasim. So, she also shares in Haj Qasim's efforts. Enduring the deprivations they faced, beside the family's deprivations, such as the absence of a husband and a father, is very important. It is very important to tolerate such things, and she tolerated them. May God reward you, bless you, and protect all of you. May you be successful and assisted by God, God willing.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Yemenis is from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other major cities and chanted slogans in praise of the Yemeni army's naval operations. They also reaffirmed their full support for the Palestinian people and pledged to continue the protests until the Israeli genocide ceases.
The Yemeni government, all its members, its president and the people have one position, which is to support the Palestinian cause. We must thwart the American, Israeli and British project and stop starvation in Palestine. Our position is an honorable position, and our broad movement indicates that the Yemenis have great awareness and, God willing, we